For the first time in 18 years, Summit County will have a new representative in Congress. But who will it be? Now that Representative Rob Bishop is not running for re-election, Republican Blake Moore and Democrat Darren Perry are vying for his seat. Who are they? Where do they stand on the issues? Find out Thursday night, September 24th, when KPCW brings you a live broadcast of the Utah 1st Congressional District debate. The action starts at 6 o'clock.
8:06, we've got 46 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and on the phone with us, meteorologist Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Park City. I hope you guys are all having a great start to your day. Keep in mind, it's hazy to start, and it's going to get worse as the day progresses. So all morning, I've been talking about an area of high pressure. That's our weather maker, and theoretically, we love those, right? However, a couple of things. A, conditions have been very dry. They continue to be dry, but the outlook looks promising. I've been talking about this for the past several weeks. Additionally, with that area of high pressure, you know, we get more smoke filtering into our forecast region. So that is the issue at hand right now, apart from anything else. The masks are certainly going to be very helpful today. I know we're all very active. We love the outdoors. I'd limit that because it's going to get a lot more dense because of that westerly influence that we're seeing under that area of high pressure. So temperatures for today are going to be in the mid-70s. We may push out an upper 70, maybe 76. I'm being a little nitpicky there. And then we're seeing low to mid-70s for tomorrow. By the end of the week, I initially had an upper 60 to low 70. We might leave us right at 70. A 70 is your expected high temperature. Now, Saturday and Sunday, we're going to keep it in the 60s, mid to upper 60s. And then Monday, we're going to see low 70s. Lots of, I'd say, dry air to end the week, but then more moisture pushes in by Friday into Saturday and Sunday, because an area of low pressure that is moisture rich is going to stay just to the north of us. That's super important, everybody. Leslie, super, super duper important, because now I'm tracking long range outlook. On air, I showed a 6 to 10 day outlook versus an 8 to 14 day outlook as far as precip is concerned. And we can see how we're starting to push more moisture into our forecast region. So kind of a long range outlook is super favorable, especially for Park City, as we track the potential for any precip and a changeover into snow. And so that long range outlook important. The weekend looks really nice. It's going to feel like fall because, well, it is fall. And then on Monday, we're going to hit those 70s, a couple of extra clouds. Overall, a nice trend ahead.
Okay.
But just be mindful of that haze.
Will do. Erica, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with the director of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, Mike Lures, along with longtime board member Jan Wilking. Park City Council member Steve Joyce in with a recap from yesterday's council meeting. And finally, the Division of Wildlife Resources Communication Director Faith Heaton Jolly with details about the annual deer hunt that opens this weekend. Stay tuned. And stay tuned also for the Mountain Life. Right after the local news hour, today's guests include Terry Chaney, who has written the book Modern Madness, an Owner's Manual. COVID-19 has launched a second pandemic, a mental health crisis in America. Then coach and athlete Adam Lewis, who competed on the U.S. Nordic combined team for 6 years, now a record-holding ultra runner and local Nordic combined coach. Well, the stage of the Eccles Center is still quiet with no shows being hosted there by the Park City Institute. The rule is that they cannot return to the Eccles stage until we get into a green safety policy period. But the Institute's managing director, Ari Ioannidis, said that they are keeping busy and generating revenue with their online shows. Rick Bruff reports that next up is a live show that'll be streaming October 7th.
Grammy-winning musician Suzanne Vega has appeared live in Park City for the Institute. Ioannidis said now they're presenting her in an online concert October 7th, live from New York with an all-star band. He said it's a unique opportunity.
She released an album on September 11th, New York's Songs and Stories, which is kind of a retrospective of her career, and they re-recorded all the albums in a small setting, sort of live. So not necessarily in front of a live audience, but they played it live, which is rare these days. Normally, especially with some Suzanne Vega songs, they're very produced. What they're doing is, in October, performing live at the Blue Note to kind of celebrate the release of this album.
Ticket price for the online show is $20 and a handling fee. He said you can go to partcityinstitute.org to register. Half of the revenue from tickets goes to the Institute. Ionita said that right now the reality of COVID means a struggle for live performance arts organizations. He said that the Eccles has plenty of room to host an event for 200 or 300 distanced attendees, but the facility is held by the Park City School District, which is reluctant to bring outsiders to the campus. Ionita said he understands that. He said he's conferring with other local promoters on the situation.
I'm new at this. I started in March. So I've relied heavily on Brian Richards, Randy Barton, all the other execs of the performing arts community. And we're all hit very, very hard. And this is an existential crisis. It really is.
Ionita said they've cut their expenses by 94%, and they have a staff of two, including him. They have scheduled a main stage season in preparation for the time they can resume activities. They have secured or tried to secure acts that they had to cancel this summer.
We've had a couple of folks call us and say they would prefer not to show. So we're ready once we go to the green level to hold shows. We unfortunately were unable to host Black Violin this summer. We did arrange to get them back next summer. So one of the things I miss most is the student outreach we've been able to do. And Black Violin, virtuoso string performers, were planning to do a whole curriculum tie-in with student outreach, which I was excited about. Parsons Dance was another group. We're trying to get them back.
Finally, we asked Ionidas if he thinks the Institute can come back from the pandemic.
There was a time when I didn't think it would. You know, I took over, we were financially strapped. I would say a lot of our patrons stepped up in a big way and either forgave loans or helped us bridge that gap. That we were also able to renegotiate every bill that was due and get all those paid off. I think we have one major bill that needs to get paid. Other than that, we're in pretty good shape. We had a very large infusion of cash from about 30 of our patrons who stepped up. You know, we sent an email out, and then we had a donor come up and match all of those donations.
Park City Institute Managing Director Ari Ionidas, who added they've also benefited from federal and state aid. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
KPCW News Time now, 8:14. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, the newly redone and newly named water reclamation plant there at Silver Creek was celebrated on Monday. In the studio, with details, I have the director of the Snohomish Basin Water Reclamation District, Mike Lurs. He's joined by longtime board member Jan Wilking. Good morning to both of you.
Morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Mike, let's just start with you. The new plant actually been operating for a while?
We started the new plant up in April. And it takes a while to kind of go through the startup phase of a new facility like this. So we started to actually treat wastewater soon thereafter. And the facility's been doing great since then. The facility was initiated some 5 years ago at a cost of, originally we estimated at $51 million, and we were able to bring it in under budget just a little over $49 million.
Okay, and that actually paid for by impact fees and then a slight increase in user fees.
Right. Approximately 93% was paid for and will continue to be paid for by new growth, and then the last little bit's paid for by current users.
Okay, well, let's talk about how long does that get us out? I mean, given the growth that we're seeing right now.
Okay, we have two water reclamation facilities, and the Silver Creek facility, again, which is located kind of north of Home Depot area, serves approximately one-third of the eastern side of Park City in the Snyderville Basin. The other two-thirds are served by the East Canyon facility. So the Silver Creek facility that we just completed will meet our needs for as far out as we can see, assuming zoning doesn't change dramatically. However, the East Canyon facility will need to be updated, not really updated, but enlarged. The capacity needs to be increased, and we're already starting on that project. We'll be starting design for that project next year.
So will you do what you did here? I mean, basically you built a new facility as you operated the old one and then demolished the old one.
Right. The next phase at Jeremy Ranch will not be of that nature. It'll be strictly adding to what we have. We already have advanced our tertiary treatment at that site, so we're simply adding capacity.
Yeah. You did add Jan Wilking's name to the front of the building there at Silver Creek. Is there a specific name for the building, or is that just a plaque honoring Jan?
We have a plaque honoring Jan. We weren't sure he would be happy to have the facility named after him, so we didn't go that far. But the entire facility is in his honor. And as you will know, Jan has served on the Water Reclamation Board from July of 1974. And I provided Jan with a copy of the original meeting minutes just a few minutes ago. And so it's been, you know, some 46 years.
Yeah. Wow. 46? Oh, yeah. 74. Jan, Rick Ruff was checking to see if you had some kind of Guinness Book of World Records as the longest sitting board member for a single governmental entity. And he thinks that you may have it after 46 years. But really, how could you stay interested in sewage for 46 years?
Well, we've been very fortunate with the people that I've had the opportunity to work with. First, I've been on many different boards here in Park City, and the one thing about the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation Board is that we've always had excellent board members, and we haven't had, say, fights that you typically see in some of these boards. And so it's a combination of the quality of the board, the people that are serving there, but also the management that we have. We've had three district managers in that 46 years, which, that lack of turnover of having always quality people there has added so much to the operations. And when you say keep my interest, it's easy because I have such great people to work with. And Mike has been so good in the quality of the people that he's hired, and also the work environment that he has created there, that our employees, seems like every month we'll have a meeting where we're honoring another employee for being there 15 years or 20 years, 25 years. And at the dedication, so many of the employees came up to me and just said how much they enjoy working there. So it's easy to keep my interest.
So you were there then when the district was formed?
Yes. Well, I was on the city council when the district was formed. And we actually had a sewer treatment plant right where the fire station is on Holiday Ranch Loop Road, right as you come into Park City. It had reached capacity and wasn't meeting treatment standards. The county could see that there was a lot of growth occurring out in the Snyderville Basin, and the EPA said that it couldn't take place unless there was a new district. So we worked together with the county and decided to create a much larger sewer treatment district or wastewater treatment district. The makeup of the district is two people get elected from Park City, two people get elected from the non-incorporated area of Snyderville Basin, and then the city gets to appoint one board member. And it seems to have worked out very well because we have great relationships with the other governmental entities, whether it's the city or the county. And I attribute a lot of that to Mike, that we have to work closely when we're doing a big project, or if the city's doing a project, a lot of times we'll have to come in and either upsize or relocate the sewer lines, and we just haven't had any conflicts.
Yeah. So any idea how many customers we had back way when in 74 compared to maybe what we have today?
When I came to Park City in 1969, and at that time I think there were 1,200 people living in Park City. there were probably half of Main Street was vacant, and some of the buildings that existed on Main Street were boarded up. The one constant is the Alamo, or what's now known as No Name. So those people were all connected to a sewer district and got their treatment. But I have no idea, Mike. That would be something to think about.
Yeah, I don't know how many customers we had at that time. So.
Yeah. Any idea what we've got now?
Now we have almost 14,000. Of course, when the district was first formed, almost all of those customers were located within the city limits. Now we actually have more customers outside the city limits than we do inside.
Yeah. Jan, as a real estate agent, I mean, you certainly ride the ups and downs of the economy. Is that reflected in sort of the issues that come before the board that you serve on, the district board?
The main way that real estate is reflected is how fast we have to increase the capacity of the plant. If it's kind of the boom year, then we have to speed up creating more capacity. And then during the slow periods, we have the ability to slow down, particularly since the impact fees won't be coming in to help us pay the bond. So we can just take a pause if we need to.
Yeah. Looks like those minutes that he handed to you were like actually typed, huh?
Well, Mike, you know, there was some question exactly when I did come on the board, or actually we created the structure that I mentioned. And yeah, Mike just brought these in, and it's July 16th of 1974. Oh. Yeah. Oh. So it's been quite a while.
Mike, it's been a very, very dry summer, and of course we've had problems that we've talked about in the past with East Canyon Creek drying up, even being fish killed. I think we came real close this summer as well.
We did. Just a little history for your listeners. East Canyon Creek at one time was a blue ribbon trout fishery. We had many springs feeding that creek year-round. Well, we all moved here. We all needed water, so a lot of that water was diverted from the springs. And that resulted in less water being in the creek. And that's especially true during these dry summer months. So now we see a situation where there's just barely enough water to keep the fish alive above Jeremy Ranch. That's a tough situation. A lot of that has to do with the way Utah water laws are in place. But I will say that since the Water Master Agreement was signed some 5 years ago. We all have committed ourselves to keeping the fish alive when situation gets critical. And again this year, and this was approximately 6 weeks ago, we contacted some of the larger water diverters out of the creek, and they all stepped up, and we were able to avoid a fish kill once again this year.
Do we have a similar problem in Silver Creek?
Silver Creek's a little different in that, number one, there's a lot of mining legacy issues associated with that creek, and there's a fish advisory, meaning you cannot eat, you know, so much fish. And the other part of that is that the creek above our discharge point does dry up every year, and the fish pretty much swim downstream, and they live in our treated wastewater. And there's quite a nice population of Bonneville cutthroat living downstream. I've personally have worked with Division of Wildlife Resources on some shocking of the fish, and I saw a 21-inch Bonneville cutthroat out of a creek that wasn't any wider than about 36 inches. So the fish are doing well downstream. The real question is when that legacy, the mining legacy area, is cleaned up, and EPA is working on that, will they be able to rebuild that section of creek to keep water in it year-round.
And then real quick, any updates with regard to that COVID-19 study that was being done with wastewater?
We continue to participate in the COVID surveillance activities. We treat our wastewater, which we do remove all the COVID, but the water coming into both of our facilities is sampled weekly. And the SARS-CoV-2 virus genetic material is looked at, and we report those results to the website that you can go online and see, so that the health departments and the Division of Water Quality and other agencies can get an idea as to if our cases are going up and down. And what, in general terms, what we're seeing not only here locally but across the state is that we generally can pick up genetic material about a week before cases will increase in any given location. And that gives the health department and the state epidemiologist a kind of a heads up that something may be changing.
Yeah, and we've kind of seen that correlation with that as we have just with numbers of people in town, yeah?
We have, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else, Yanni, wanted to mention? I mean, any plans to retire now that you've got your name on a building?
You know, I really haven't given that any thought, but a couple people have asked, and, you know, I'm enjoying it. We, like I say, we have a great board. We have a great management team there. We have great employees. And it's something that I enjoy doing. It's just a good way for me to provide service to the community. So I really haven't thought of it.
Okay. Anything, Mike, you want to add?
Yeah, Jan's not retiring until we get our next project built, number one. Number two, just want to mention, Leslie, that the district was fortunate to receive two National Environmental Achievement Awards this week. The East Canyon Water Reclamation Facility receiving an award for 100% compliance with all environmental permit requirements for 16 consecutive years. And kudos to our staff, because that takes a lot of hard work to do that. And we received a similar award for the Silver Creek facility for 100% compliance for 17 consecutive years. And that's not easy to do. So again, kudos to the staff for really protecting our local environment.
All right. Congratulations to you, too. Hey, guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Mike Lors and Jan Wilking. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW News Time Now, 828. It's 829. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Council met virtually yesterday. In the studio with a recap of the meeting, I have Council Member Steve Joyce. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So why the Tuesday meeting? We had things going on Thursday or something?
It was so long ago that we actually set this up. I think it was the Utah League of Cities and Towns had an annual meeting, and we were scheduling around that. And then, of course, COVID came and the meeting didn't happen. But we stick with the schedule just because it's easier. Everybody plans around it.
Okay. Let's see. The discussion on the vibrancy ordinance, which is, of course, in place to keep Main Street lively and lit up through the year. The staff says that the order has been a success since it went into effect about 3 years ago. Because of COVID, the council didn't conduct a vibrancy inspection in second quarter and indicated that it was, though, in favor of enforcing it for the third and fourth quarter, kind of adopting a more case-by-case basis moving forward then?
Yeah, I think we're going to try to adjust. I think it's if any time was going to be important for us to have a vibrant Main Street, I think this is it. I mean, it's just got to, there's going to be businesses having a tough time, but you don't want to go to a dead Main Street where, you know, a third of the businesses are closed or whatever. And so, you know, I think what we want to do, though, is really focus if it's a need-driven thing versus just, you know, what we historically were trying to get rid of, which was people who left their businesses dark all year, open for Sundance, and then closed again immediately. That's what we're trying to avoid. And it had gotten better, but we've actually, quite frankly, I think seen a couple of cases where, like, some of the little art groups were down in one or two of the buildings, and now they're not. So I don't know what's going to happen there, but, you know, and Sundance is going to look completely different this year. And so what we don't want to have is, you know, Sundance's void compared to a normal year create a big party atmosphere down here just with, you know, buildings opening up and that kind of thing. So we'll live and learn as we go along.
All right. So, I mean, any specific circumstances that you would enforce it if somebody was violating?
Well, I think clearly the ones that we've had that we know that are just the recurring ones who've already used their 1 year exception and that kind of thing, they're going to be the obvious targets.
Okay. Let's see. A busy Main Street, and I'm just kind of, this is off the agenda, but on Sunday, car free, and there was a lot of kind of just speculation on social media. It's like the city council will allow something like this, but we've canceled every other event in town. And there just seemed to be some, you know, it just doesn't square with people, you know. It's like we can't have Halloween, but we can have, you know, crowds walking down Main Street on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I wonder how many of the people who are saying that are actually down here on Sundays, though. Because if you walk here on Sunday, and I've been down quite a number of them, for the most part, people really are socially distanced. People are wearing masks. People are spread out. And if you compare that to something like, you know, the Halloween, as you brought up, or the Arts Festival or something, where we bring 55,000 people in for a weekend. It's like the compactness and the social distancing would just be non-existent there. And so, and we've asked Rich Ballaw a number of times of just, you know, for the contact tracing that you're doing, are you able to show anything coming back to any of these events? And the answer has been no.
Okay. So as you mentioned, Sundance will look a lot different come January. Are there reasons you think that some owners could justify staying closed until then?
I haven't heard anything yet. I guess it's the difference between a building owner and a business owner. You know, for a lot of the people don't own the business that they're working out of. And at some point, maybe if you're a building owner and you lost your tenant, and we've had a couple of those go on, then maybe you're just hanging on hoping for something better. But I don't know. Everything I've heard so far says people are fighting tooth and nail to stay open and doing everything they possibly can. I think that's what we've seen with things like the Sundays, where people are trying to get really creative of how to stay open and some of the curbside deliveries and things like that.
Okay. Also, a discussion with regard to the Wasatch Transit Study, a presentation that's actually been made to Wasatch Summit Heber city officials. City Manager Matt Dias said that the study did some myth-busting when it comes to people thinking that there's no cooperation or connection between all of these entities. In terms of that, I mean, how important is regional cooperation when we move forward with public transit?
Oh, I think it's absolutely huge. I mean, we've had it going on for years now between Summit County and Park City. And so to the point where we've really had a shared transit system that served both. Now we're trying to really kind of differentiate a little bit and maybe have Park City focus on more of our services and Summit County stepping up to the plate and saying, we'll take care of the regional pieces. But regional, I mean, we've had the Salt Lake Connector for a while, so that's kind of our one little drop down into the Wasatch Front. But a lot of our workforce comes from places like, you know, Heber, Midway, but also like Camas, Colville, Oakley. And so we've got the Camas bus running now, the Black Line. And I think this is just kind of a natural extension of that, only we're now into somebody else's territory. So it's not just Summit County, and we have to start working with other people.
Right. And it's paid for with tax dollars?
It's up in the air. I mean, they were showing that, you know, the way we pay for ours here is there's these 0.25% increments that both the county and the city can use. And we fund almost all of our transit with those, other than the federal grants and things we get. But right now, Heber has used 0.25% of their possible ones, and Wasatch County hasn't used any. So there's a lot of potential there. They said they could raise between if they went with 0.25%, they could get $2 million, a little over two. And if they did all five of them, they could be up at $11 million a year. So there's a lot of potential there. And it's just a matter of, you know, Utah's one of these places that doesn't like taxes. And so how bad do you want it? And I think the interesting thing we saw from the transit study was people seemed really interested. They wanted pretty extensive transit.
Yeah. So how involved will Park City be in the future? Because as you mentioned, and as the mayor mentioned yesterday, Park City is kind of getting out of that regional transit service.
Well, it's going to take us a good while to do that. Although that COVID's actually provided an opportunity that I think between the county and the city, we're actually able to move along faster than we thought we were going to be able to. Just because ridership is down now. And so if you're going to make changes, now is the time. It's kind of easier and faster. We will certainly be involved. I mean, we're certainly, even as the area around us changes, we are really either a destination or, you know, for a lot of these places for workforce, we're at one end or the other of a transit ride very often. So we have to be very involved. And we have very aggressive goals. And for us to say we want to get cars off of 248, if we're not working with the people at the other end of 248 that are coming and going, then it's kind of meaningless. So,
we know that this, of course, is a real long-term project. You had said that you were hoping to see some real progress, though, in the next 1 to 3 years. What kind of progress would you like to see?
Well, they talked about a pilot of really, I think they were talking about aiming at the workforce primarily, as the because that tends to be a little bit more predictable on when people come and go, and it's more consistent than seasonal. And so I think that would be a nice one, is just start with kind of a narrow range, kind of like we've done with Camas, where we started with like two rides a day and it was working and we were filling it up. So we started adding lines, and now we're starting to hear from other places like the Oakleys and Colvilles and Piolas and stuff going, where's my bus? And so, you know, just a good pilot would be good. But I think part of the challenge with that is it's going to take the Heber Valley, Wasatch County stepping up and deciding how they would fund things.
All right, the Park City Visioning 2020, you heard a presentation on the initiative aiming, of course, to provide an open, inclusive, and transparent future for Park City, and asked if the council should reprioritize your efforts due to the pandemic. Councilmember Max Doyle said that the city should be proactive, not reactive, when it comes to this initiative. Is it hard to think proactively, though, when all we've been doing is basically reacting this year?
Yeah, it's really, you know, COVID kind of threw a monkey wrench in this, and the timing was just impeccable, where we were just finishing the whole visioning thing in February. We were starting to get ready to crank up staff on how are we going to go deliver all this and get everything started, and boom, you know, what was it, mid-March that everything fell apart. So this is really kind of the first effort to get things started again. But I think everybody has to remember this was a 10-year visioning. This was kind of it's the difference between tactical and strategic. This was the long-term strategic, where do we want to take the city? And even as devastating as COVID's been, it really doesn't change. It shouldn't change, I believe, the kind of the 10-year goal. So I think mostly what we kind of settled on was, you know, the whole coronavirus has really pushed on the affordability and equity piece, because we've seen a lot of disparity between the people who had to go to work and the people who have eight people living in their house instead of a couple, you know, and people can work from home, others can't. And it's like we've really seen the differences grow even bigger than they already were, and they were already substantive. So Max was suggesting that we kind of, at least at the tactical level, not necessarily the 10-year level, bump our focus up on affordability and equity and really try to keep our eye on that one and start taking even more action.
Yeah. Any of the other kind of critical pillars that you felt like are basically reaffirmed by COVID?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see. I think all of them are still, you know, there. I don't think anything's really dramatically changed on what people want Park City to be. But the one that was kind of probably going to get knocked around the most was transit. That was the highest on everybody's list. 248 was fresh in everybody's mind. Everybody's like, you got to be looking at alternative forms of transit. And we know we still need to do that. And yet transit ridership is way off. I mean, you've reported on that here, and it's going to take a while to recover. And so, you know, at the same time, the sales taxes that pay for our transit are way off. And so we're going to have to tweak that one. It hasn't really changed it. And again, we may have some more opportunity that says, hey, while the ridership's down, maybe we can actually get to some of these goals of different mechanisms even quicker. But who knows? We're just, you know, it's been such a, as you put it, kind of a reactive mode for the last 6 months. I think this is really kind of the turning around point, or at least I hope so.
Councilmember Tim Henney said that the city's been tasked with bold action, not bold change, when it comes to the 10-year vision for the city. You agreed with that. So what actions should be taken now?
Yeah, I think that's what we're really trying to go back and restart. I mean, we're always working on these things. I mean, if you take things like our environmental leadership, I mean, we just won an award from, what is it, the World Wildlife Foundation for the U.S., and now we're competing at the world level. I mean, we're working on our solar plans just right down the street here from you. You know, we've put in electric car chargers. I mean, we're always doing things. But what we were looking for is the next big steps to take. And quite frankly, the last 6 months, we haven't been focused on what are the next big steps that we should take. So I think this was step one of getting back to that and getting the community back engaged and getting our staff and our council back engaged to start thinking that way.
So at this point, no action plan?
No, I don't think we know what we're doing yet.
Yeah. Let's see. Not a whole lot of a few public comments, I guess I should say, on the Park City transit discussion. I guess it's like, what's the best way for people to get involved when in this, you know, if they do want to see some changes to what's happening with transit?
Well, I'll give you the bad answer, which was about 3 weeks ago, we started running a pretty extensive survey. and we got a lot of feedback. You guys were kind enough to cover it for us. And we got a lot of feedback from residents, from workforce, from businesses. And we used that and then had some meetings with some of our biggest like trip generators, like the ski resorts and some of the bigger hotels and things like that. And so we had quite a bit. It was very extensive input. And so, you know, the easiest answer would have been, give us your input 3 weeks ago. But we will still continue to work on this. We have JTAB meetings. JTAB is the Joint Transit Advisory Board, which is the county and the city working together. The next meeting is October 20th. And we are doing those meetings electronically, but we always have public input. But the biggest thing is we're going to be watching as we get into winter. What do the ski resorts really look like? How much visitation do we have? What does the hiring look like? What is the impact of J1s and things like this? And are people getting comfortable getting back on the bus? And then we'll start looking at whether we need to tweak the system again.
All right. And then just wanted to also mention about the 2021 budget. You agreed to open the budget back up to address a few new requests. You said the city budget should reflect the 2021 projections as much as possible. So do you think there'll be more changes after October 13th? And I don't, that's just in the next day that you, the next date
yeah,
you discuss it?
I think we're going to continue. I mean, the fact that everybody's got their crystal ball out and trying to guess what the winter looks like. And so much of this town's revenue, whether you're a business on Main Street or certainly the ski areas or whatever, it's really, you know, it's December through March. That's where you make your money. And we don't know what it's going to look like. I mean, we're seeing Utah spike right now. I don't know whether that's going to have an impact. People are reluctant to fly. So a lot of our international travel may be down, you know, dramatically. Even the workforce changes, you know, without J1s this year, they're getting some college gap years and some, what is it, H-2B visas. But, you know, what's that going to look like? And no one knows.
Current projections indicate a 36% decrease in sales tax revenues. The big takeaway is that 2021 will be filled with uncertainty. You heard from your financial analyst, Eric Danitz, say to expect pain this winter. So what's the city doing to prepare for a potentially rough winter season?
Well, the news we got yesterday was some good news and some bad news compared to our projections that we did back when we finished the budget back in June. We were looking then and we thought the summer was going to be down to just dead, you know, financially dead. And it turned out that for sales tax, as everybody's seen, it's been busier than I think anybody expected. And we actually came in the 3 months of April, May, June, we were $1.3 million above what we projected for sales tax. Unfortunately, we also projected kind of a faster recovery than we're now looking at. And so, you know, that takes us through some more of the lucrative months. So by the time we get balanced with everything, we ended up about $500,000 drop. We went from 36% drop of sales tax for fiscal year 2021 down to 43% drop. So that was worse. But the $1.3 million took us ahead. So we're kind of... We think we're in okay shape, but boy, we're just, you know, we're not going to start spending money.
Can we handle another year like 2020 if the COVID situation doesn't improve?
It'll certainly look different. I mean, we've tapped our reserves some, but not a whole lot. We've been very careful about that because we didn't know what the future was going to be. But I think, you know, the downside is if we go through another year and you start actually losing businesses. So far, the businesses have been amazingly resilient. I know everybody's struggling, but most of them are still here. I mean, every year, normal, even in a great financial year, we still lose businesses. So it's not like everybody survives every year. And but if you start really seeing some big businesses go under, then it starts just this kind of cascading chain of, you know, we lose not, you know, 20 or 30% of that tax, we lose all of that. And, you know, so it impacts the city and the services we can deliver, which of course makes the, you know, our overall target of people coming to Park City go down as well.
Yeah, we heard from the governor yesterday, you know, 13, 14 counties already into that green phase. Do you expect Summit County to be into that green phase for this winter?
You know, I think everybody's doing their part. It's really great to see, you know, just like you mentioned the Sunday, car-free Sundays. And people are wearing their masks. They're doing the right things. Everybody seems to be working as hard as they can. But we're still a resort town, and we got a lot of people coming from other places, both for our workforce. So, I mean, you've seen Utah County spike so bad lately. They just went back to orange yesterday. But we get workforce from there. We get workforce from Salt Lake, and Salt Lake's been running back up again. We get visitors from all over the world, and certainly, you know, all over Utah this time of year. I don't know how we get to green for a while. I just think there's too much variation for us.
Okay, Steve, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that was good, and thanks to everybody for participating yesterday.
Steve Joyce, member of the Park City Council, thanks for your time this morning. KPCW News Time now, 8:47. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. South Summit School District updated us with details on their back-to-school protocols under a pandemic, master planning, as well as introducing their new high school principal. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has this update.
South Summit School District has been lucky, according to Superintendent Chad Sorensen, who says the schedule they have devised gives them one day during the week to perform a deep clean while all students and teachers are working from home.
Actually, there's three different plans. One group is completely virtual that have chosen to do it that way. And we have another group that are attending school Mondays and Tuesdays in person. This is in our Camas schools. Everybody is a remote learning day on Wednesday, and then they attend again in person on Thursday and Friday. And then our Silver Summit is just tweaked a little bit from that. High school students attend 2 days in person, and the rest is virtual, and middle school attend 2 days in person and then virtual on alternate days.
Sorensen says they have been able to offer options for teachers who want to teach from home. They have not had any teacher resignations since the start of school, and he says the staff is gaining confidence in handling the challenges of virtual learning. There has been one COVID-19 case diagnosed in the school district, which was handled according to county health guidelines. Due to continued growth and academic needs, the district purchased two portables. Sorensen says one will provide a state-of-the-art science center at the school.
We have two portables, one over at Silver Summit to handle some of the growth there. It's a very temporary portable as we finish off building two. And then we have a brand new science lab coming on board for our South Summit High School in Camas next month. It is amazing. The portables were brought on a semi-trailer. They were lifted by crane onto a permanent foundation. They're putting on a roof now.
Three board seats are up for election in November, and he says future school bond decisions will be up to the new board members. For now, he says the trailers will help buy them time. A new high school principal, Chris Jensen, joined the district this summer. His background is a teacher, then assistant principal, and for the past 6 years, he was the principal of Highland High School in Salt Lake City.
At Highland High School for 27 years, and my wife Angie and I, we lived in Draper, and I've made that commute from Draper to Salt Lake for that many years, and the opportunity came to come up to South Summit, and it's just a dream to be able to have this opportunity to come up and serve this wonderful community. It's been wonderful. I can't tell you, I feel like I've died and gone to heaven here.
They're hosting football games and other sports, but not without constant reminders about mask wearing and social distancing. Jensen says in his first weeks, they hosted a socially distant but successful homecoming out on the football field.
We worked very closely with the Summit County Health Department and with Chad and board and to provide an experience for the kids. It was a little chilly. We did it outside on the football field and had our masks and all of our chaperones and everything. It was a lot of fun, but pretty cold.
$30,000 in CARES money has been donated to the school district by Camas City to help pay for PPE in the schools. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
KPCW News Time now, 8:51. Well, the annual deer hunt starts this weekend, and there are plenty of rules to follow. On the phone with the hunting primer, I have the Division of Wildlife Resources Communication Director, Faith Heaton-Jolly. Good morning, Faith.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so is it just deer that people are hunting, or is it also opening of the elk, moose, bear, and other hunts that the state offers?
So actually, we just recently finished up our archery hunts for deer and for elk. And the general season hunts for those actually don't start for a couple more weeks. So the general season for elk starts October 3rd, and the general season for deer starts October 17th. So we are still a little ways out, but it's a good time for people to start thinking about it, start prepping, sight in their rifles, things like that. And then we do have a couple hunts that are currently underway. We have some upland game hunts and also some waterfowl hunts.
Okay. So what there are certainly a couple of resources people can access before embarking on their hunting trip. How do people learn about the conservation restrictions?
Yeah, so we strongly recommend before anybody, heads out into the field for their hunt this fall, to read the appropriate guidebooks. So if you're hunting deer and elk, you'll want to read the whole Big Game Field Regulations guidebook. If you're hunting waterfowl, you'll want to read the waterfowl guidebook. You can pick up physical copies of those at, different sportsman stores or at any of our regional offices, or you can find all of those online as well on our website. But those are really, really crucial in just basically telling you exactly what you need to know, some specific things to be aware of, including weapon type, how to tag your animal, when you need to wear hunter orange, things like that. So those are really important to just making sure that you're following the law, you know the law, and that you can have a safe and enjoyable hunt.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing about hunting. I mean, it's such a generational thing. It's just information that's passed down from generation to generation. Young kids go out with their dad or grandparents or something and kind of learn the rules. Do things change often enough, though, that people need to stay updated?
They do, and that's kind of why we recommend, even if you've been hunting the same unit for decades, it's really, really important for you to read those guidebooks before each season because, we do have some of those regulations. We'll have minor, things that change or that are updated or, whatever. And so we want to make sure that people are aware of those before they head out into the field. That's a great spot to look for. It is all just in that guidebook.
Okay. And hunters do make common mistakes. Tell us about some of them. I think one of them is just not looking at their permit.
Yes, we do have a couple instances. Our conservation officer said they'll run into that at about every year, honestly, where people just, they put in for a specific permit and then they just assume that that's what they drew. And so they don't even open the envelope. They don't even read that full permit. And then they'll, harvest their animal and realize, their permit is actually for an elk and they assumed it was for a deer, So that's super important is just make sure you actually know what permit you drew, what unit, what those boundaries are, what species. And that's probably the most common mistake that our officers say they see is just people killing wildlife or fishing without that valid license or without that permit. And yeah, like I said, sometimes it's just due to not even opening the envelope. Sometimes they'll leave their license or permit at home. So those are things just make sure before you head out that you've got all of those things. Just like if you're about to head out and drive your car, you want to make sure you have your license and registration with you. It's the same type of thing. You need those appropriate licenses and permits to be able to harvest an animal.
Yeah. How often is it that somebody shoots the wrong animal?
Yeah, so I was talking to our law enforcement about this. They said it's not too common, but we do get a couple cases every year where somebody will either wrongfully identify and then shoot either the wrong species altogether. They have a permit for an elk and then they accidentally shoot a moose or something. Or the more common one is they just shoot the wrong sex. So, in fact, just last week we had somebody that shot a ram that they thought was an ewe, a female bighorn sheep, because both of them can sometimes have small horns, when it's a younger ram. So that's kind of the more common mistake is just, harvesting the wrong gender. So, but most of the time when that does happen, these individuals will realize that they made that mistake and they'll, report it. And so we definitely encourage people to do that. If you do, happen to make a mistake while you're hunting or fishing, call up one of our conservation officers. They can help you sort it out. And then, we can go from there. But that's definitely something that we recommend. And then also just before you pull the trigger, make sure you're really certain of your target and what's beyond it.
Yeah, and I know that these are legal. They're hunting blinds. You know, they're basically where people kind of set up cameras to kind of watch the comings and goings of animal. I mean, I noticed one at the top of the ridge. I mean, we're talking about 50 yards maybe from the popular Crest Trail where somebody had baited perhaps deer with corn and apples. I mean, is something like this so close to a very popular and well-used recreation area allowed?
You know what, it is. We basically just, there's Utah code that prohibits, you know, discharging a firearm or a dangerous weapon from a vehicle, from a road or across a road, or within 600 feet of a house or some other kind of structure. And so those are things to be aware of. You know, there's hunting rules that we have in our guidebooks. There's also state rules, and then there's also city rules. You know, some cities completely prohibit, and they have rules that you can't discharge any firearms within their city limits. So those are also things to be aware of and to make sure you're checking before you go out and you go hunting. And being within a certain, there's rules about being within a certain distance of a trailhead and things like that. So that's why we tell hunters, like, you need to be certain of your target and especially what's beyond it, you know, so you're not endangering somebody else while you're on your hunt.
Okay. With the stage 1 fire restrictions in place, target shooting is illegal in a number of places. So how can the hunt happen in those areas?
Yeah, so typically with target shooting, the reason it's dangerous is because people will shoot at, you know, metal objects that can cause sparks, or they'll shoot sometimes even at exploding targets. With the hunting, you know, you're obviously just shooting at animals, which isn't going to cause sparks, you know, when you hit an animal. But that is something to, you know, be aware of and be mindful of as well as people are out hunting this year is, you know, you do need to be very careful and very, you know, certain of your target and what you're aiming at, because there have been several, like you mentioned, there have been several wildfires started this year from target shooting. And so that's, you know, that's one thing to be mindful of, as well as just when you're out hunting, you know, there's a lot of areas that have also restricted campfires right now. I know the Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands restricted open fires on any state lands unless there's like an established campground or fire ring. So that's something to be aware of too, that you might not be able to light, you know, the fire at the end of the day like you have in the past. So we definitely recommend people check with those land managing agencies, you know, before they light a campfire as well, because like you said, it's really dry this year and there's really that chance for a fire to start if we're not careful.
I'm out of town, but I did want to just note that there is also a sandhill crane hunt.
There is, yep. That one actually, there's a couple different periods for it. One of those just recently ended. But if somebody, you know, and those are kind of a limited hunt, you had to apply and get a permit earlier this year. But if somebody just wants to go see sandhill cranes this time of year, this is a great time to see them. And we're actually holding an event October 3rd. We're going to have 2 vehicle tours, 1 in the morning, 1 in the evening. It'll be out in the Uinta Basin area. And people can just go with our biologists, kind of go on this driving tour. So it'll be socially distanced, and they can see some of these sandhill cranes in the wild. And it's pretty cool. They're a pretty unique species.
Okay. I got to leave it there. Faith, so much for your time. That's Faith Heaton-Jolly with DWR. This is KPCW Park City.